Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast. All right. Thank you for another episode of the Family Office Real Estate Institute Insights. Today, I have with us Ethan Penner, who is author of a book, Greatness is a Choice, also the president of Mosaic, and the person that actually created the CMBS. Ethan, thanks for being on the show.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be with you, DJ.
So I had a chance to go through your book, which I want to talk about, but in order to get to the book where, and you've mentioned this before in the way I read it, is things that you've learned over your career, right? Mm-hmm. And that you've learned in life as a whole.
Yes.
So let's go back to the beginning. And you mentioned some of this in the book too, but you grew up outside the city and then you started working down on Wall Street in the beginning of your career, correct?
Yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of a in between there, but that captures the highlights. I mean, I moved to California for a little bit, worked in the savings and loan industry before I found my way back home to New York to Wall Street.
Gotcha. Where were you in California?
Well, my first job was in Huntington Beach at a little savings and loan called Mercury Savings, about $1 billion savings and loan. A very, very unsophisticated home mortgage lender that, because of broadened charter given to savings loans incorrectly by Congress, they went from this very unsophisticated, very simple home mortgage lending business, and all of a sudden found themselves, like all savings loans at that time, with the authority to basically do whatever the hell they wanted to do with taxpayer-backed deposits. And like most savings and loans, found themselves upside down and then ultimately out of business and shut down because of insolvency probably 5, 6, 7 years later. It was a terrible failed experiment and opened my eyes, really. And so, you know, we generally at ages that I'm at and even that you're at, we generally don't reflect too much about like first jobs out of college. They tend to be not that important. And believe me when I tell you, they were not highly paid. You know, for me, it was unbelievably bad. But when I reflect upon what I saw and therefore what I learned in that very first year out of college, it set an amazing foundation for everything in my career, including being able to write the book. You know, I really began to understand how inept our government is and how at fault our government is because of its ineptitude for so much disaster and carnage in our financial markets and our economy. And I think we're seeing that playing out again right now. And I think it's been a theme for my 40 years of adulthood, you know, and I got to see it front and center the first year out of college, which was, I guess, a blessing.
All right. So then it sounds like the savings and loans closed down. Is that when you headed back to New York?
Well, no, the savings and loans ultimately got kind of shuttered for the most part around 1989, 1990, which is around the time that I actually started creating the CMBS business, because that shutting down of an entire segment of our financial system began to create the panic that ultimately created the void in real estate finance that I filled. I got this early experience in the savings loan industry with the first one, which was a very unsophisticated one. And then I moved over as my girlfriend got accepted to a medical school up in San Francisco, to a very sophisticated one. And just by chance, I found myself at a place called Homestead Savings, which was one of the couple of pioneering players in the development of the secondary mortgage market, along with two or three firms on Wall Street, Salomon, First Boston, and Merrill Lynch. And so I just kind of like stumbled into a front row seat as a participant, even in the very, very, very earliest stages of the secondary mortgage market. Before then, lenders like savings loans would make loans with deposits and hold them to maturity. They were not selling them. So this whole idea of packaging and selling loans to investors was just beginning as I got out of college. And this second job I had gave me a front row seat and opened my eyes to how I would make it back to New York and make it back to Wall Street. I really didn't have a plan. I had a desire. I just didn't have a plan. And this kind of stumbling onto this job opened my eyes to that plan.
So was it then in San Francisco that you sort of started to create the foundation? And where were you in the thought process for creating the CMBS?
Well, back then, I just started to see that this business of making markets in pools of single family loans was just beginning and was going to be very, very big. And I saw that the three firms I mentioned were already succeeding and making good money at it on Wall Street, and that the other major firms on Wall Street were aiming to follow their lead. And that I had, even though I was only a few years out of college and did not have an MBA, I had better than an MBA because, you know, mortgage finance was not being taught in graduate business schools anywhere because there was no secondary mortgage market. There was no, it was not, it was a very unsophisticated business. And so I realized that I had, by just great happenstance, stumbled upon a path that would distinguish me on Wall Street. And I knew that I could make it to Wall Street in that game. I found my way to Drexel as a early generation mortgage-backed securities trader. So let's call it, I was one of the OGs, you know, as they say in today's parlance. And I was the credit guy. So, you know, on the trading floor, you'd have different individuals would trade different products, make markets in different products. The Ginnie Mae guy, the Fannie and Freddie guy, the CMO guy, the IOPO guy, and then there was the credit guy who traded pools of uninsured, non-guaranteed mortgages. That was me. And so I've always been the credit guy. And then that created the kind of genesis of everything that came after that for me. I went to Morgan Stanley and built mortgage finance and mortgage trading from scratch there. I left Drexel after 2 years, very heavy-heartedly because I love Drexel, but the opportunity for a young man to come in and create something at Morgan Stanley from scratch was too enticing for me to pass up. And it was at Morgan Stanley, in that position, its location in commercial real estate, that, and I started to kind of think, gee, the securitization technology and approach that had been so successfully applied to single family mortgages and other assets could help solve the dislocation that was so significant at that time in commercial real estate finance. And Morgan Stanley, the powers that be at that time, felt like most people in power at that time, scared of real estate, scared of touching that industry with their principal. And you know, you can't blame them. I mean, people had lost historic amounts in real estate in the preceding couple of years. But I knew that it was time to run into the burning building. The fire was abating and there was huge opportunity. Morgan Stanley, as I said, didn't want to do that. So I ran out of Morgan Stanley and started my own firm to address this incredible historic opportunity created by a vacuum of lending that had dissipated completely. And I created the CMBS paradigm. You know, it wasn't called CMBS. There was no name for it at the time. I was just doing what became CMBS, and later found my way about a year later to being backed by Nomura Securities, which at the time was the largest financial company in the world, and found myself at the age of 31 or 32, the only person, the only company kind of with money to finance real estate. So it was a very enviable position. And I was able to take that position and create a dominant business and a dominant brand for Nomura and ultimately for myself, and build a kind of an industry around that dislocation.
So the story that you're telling, you know, really to me emphasizes, you know, two chapters in your book, chapter 44, chapter 45, where you're talking about the importance of timing and trusting our instincts. Yes. So it seemed like that was a combination of both from what you're saying. So, but led by trusting your instincts, would you agree with that?
100%. Although I have to say, I saw it so clearly, DJ, you know, I think that I could probably point to a number of reasons why I see things in life sometimes differently than everybody else. But that was one of those moments where I saw purely how opportune things were. I saw purely how profitable each transaction I was doing was. When everybody else saw a danger, I didn't see any danger. I saw the safest, most lucrative business I had ever seen. And I think it was because everybody saw danger, you know? And so like, it was a very important lesson for me to kind of be part of and to capitalize upon. I learned a lot about life and about people, about herd thinking. And I know, you know, my book talks a lot about herd thinking, and I learned a lot about myself. And of course, you know, the first year or two that I was very active, I was being derided by the, you know, majority of the financial world, who thought I was crazy and taking undue risks with Nomura's money. And, you know, of course, 1, 2, 3 years later, all of the derision turned into emulation.
Right. So, you know, one of the things that I've learned from working for the number of patriarchs I have is that they'll surround themselves with great people, but at the end of the day, they're going to bet on themselves. And they're going to make that decision. So, you know, with so many people that were questioning what you were doing and if it could work, et cetera, how did you get the people on board and to support you to actually take those steps?
Yeah. Well, remember, I had had some standing by virtue of my success at Morgan Stanley, especially. So I had a lot of credibility built up from a great run at Morgan Stanley that was about a 6-year run where I was one of the leading people in the history, really, of structured finance and structured mortgage finance. So I had credibility built up. I wasn't just someone who literally came to this world of Wall Street out of left field with no standing. I had a lot of standing, and I think that helped a lot. And I was one of those group of people who built structured mortgage finance from scratch. So having had that track record, I had the standing that people tend to believe that I, you know, believed in me. There were people who knew me who believed in me. And my key people were people who were very close to me. You know, I brought in one of my right-hand guys from Morgan Stanley. So he was really right there with me from the Morgan Stanley days and came in and knew me. You know, he knew who I was, and intimately. I brought in another guy who was someone, oddly enough, that I met in, I lived in Mill Valley outside of San Francisco, and he was my next door neighbor. And he was one of the smartest people I'd ever met. And by weird coincidence, was a Dartmouth Business School classmate of a number of my boss at Morgan Stanley and a number of other senior people there, who all uniformly said he was the smartest person in their school. So, so it was people who were close to me. And that was a foundation for the first group of people that I brought into Morgan Stanley, who knew me, had faith in me. And then success begets following, right? We were successful right out of the box. And anyone who kind of came into my office even in that first year, and saw the economics and the kinds of business we were doing, understood that we were taking almost no risk and making large profit margins. And, you know, if you didn't see it, you weren't qualified to work for me. You know, it was that obvious. So it was a good, I guess, a good screening tool. You know, those who were not smart enough to see it, I really didn't want them anyway.
You know, the going back to the timing part, you know, a person that was very well known, respected in our industry, unfortunately passed away a number of months ago, Sam Zell. You know, he was buying when everybody was running the other way. And I remember reading something one time where he said he started questioning himself because he'd be the only person at the closing table and nobody else was around. Right. And, you know, that goes based upon the contrarian method. The first principal I worked for, I mean, he was a definitely on the contrarian side. I believe you, if I remember correctly, in your book, you talked about the contrarian component of it, which seems to me is, you know, combines with that timing aspect.
I think contrarianism is a very powerful asset, very, very powerful. And it encompasses having a lot of a certain combination of qualities. You have to trust yourself, right? And in the end, very few people do. Very few people, you know, the first chapter of my book, and it's the first chapter for a specific reason, it talks about self-esteem. And self-esteem is elusive. It's something that I think too few people even pursue, kind of in a conscious level, but it's the most important thing to own, right? If you own true self-esteem, where you kind of feel confident about yourself on a deep level, not arrogant, not cocky, and self-esteem doesn't come to you because you're rich. It doesn't come to you because you're good looking. It doesn't come to you because people pay a lot of attention to you. Self-esteem comes to you because in the dark of the night, when you're laying in bed and you're going to sleep and you reflect upon what you did that day and who you are as a human being and how you conducted yourself in the world, you really think, you know what? I'm a pretty good person. And that feeling of self-esteem, which is, like I said, a package of a lot of qualities and it achieves on many different levels, is a foundation for having the courage to be someone who goes against or lives outside of the herd, right? The herd is where most people live and where most people kind of have their opinions. And the ability to go against the herd and or out be outside the herd, which Sam obviously was one of the great ones at doing, and I like to think I'm pretty good at it too, I think it all comes from that self-esteem. And I think that's why my book, you know, my book is, people ask me, what kind of a book did you write? You know, did you write a business book? And I said, well, yes, and more, right? I think it's about how to be great, right? And how to find yourself, your real self, and how to think about the world in a correct and great way. And it's applicable to every facet of life by design, not business for sure, but much more than business.
So when did that crossover start to happen? I mean, I can tell you for myself personally, you know, there's a number of things you go through, right? Because you're young, you're still growing. So that sometimes that confidence can also come from arrogance, right? And
well, that's not real confidence. I think that's fake confidence, right?
Yes.
And by the way, I think you're pointing to something that's dead on, but go ahead, keep going, because I want to hear where you're going to take this. But I have a feeling, because we're so close, that I can anticipate we're going to take it. And I agree with you, but let me hear the full.
Yeah. So, and you know, it gets to the point, and it varies, I think, from person to person, where they, and a lot of times it's people as they definitely get older from the experience where they just stop caring, you know, what people think, and they start really believing in themselves. You know, I think that varies. But where for you did it go from that where did the, you know, I don't want to say cockiness, but the confidence and arrogance turned into, and I'm not saying that you were, but I'm just saying, was there ever a time that it really crossed over and you're like, okay, you know, because of who you developed as a person?
I think it's a dance every day. I don't think it's one of those things that you cross over. Yes, I do think that there's maturity moments, right?
Yeah.
No question. Where youthful arrogance gives way to, gives way, okay, to what I don't know, but it gives way. So I do think that there's a dance to be had every single day. This measurement, this idea of going to bed, we go to bed every night, or we rinse our faces in our bathroom every morning and every night, and we get a chance to look at ourselves, whether it's looking at ourselves in the mirror in the bathroom or kind of metaphorically as we close our eyes and go to bed, and we get to score ourselves. Like, are we proud of ourselves? Did we conduct ourselves that day well? And I think self-esteem can be earned and lost daily. Okay. So it's not something that can be held without effort and consciousness. And it's not something that once achieved is permanent. I don't believe that. And so that's one thing. And I definitely had, and I look back, of course, like I think most people who attain a certain age, and you know, for sure, I'm embarrassed by some of the things that I might have said or thought about myself even at a younger age, and go, wow, I really thought I knew everything and I acted that way, and how little I really knew is embarrassing, you know, and how I perhaps conducted myself is embarrassing.
But that I also think has to do with a reason for the success, you know. I mean, if you think about some of the great people, whether it is, you know, that's done a lot, Bill Gates, right, or Zuckerberg or whatnot. I mean, they were they didn't know better.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, you know, one of the reasons why I think a lot of people they draft younger people is because you're not to that stage where you're like, well, maybe I can't, or maybe this, or maybe that.
I think that that's true, and it goes to perhaps another one of my chapters about advice giving. And how I question the value of advice giving, because generally speaking, wise older people feel they have advice to give to younger people who haven't yet achieved some wisdom. And I really challenge that. For the reason you're saying is, like, the world depends upon brashness, and the world depends upon almost like 100% commitment without fear and without even noticing the downside, right? And I think and war is a good example of that, right? Charging the hill, you know, the metaphor of charging the hill. There's a reason young people are charging the hill and not old people, because old people would charge with the same fervor, right? The same, they'd be charging much more cautiously, and the hill needs to be charged with blind ambition and blind fervor. And that's not necessarily a quality that's typical of people over a certain age. So the world needs that, not just in war, but the world needs that in every facet. And I think it's not appropriate for old people. And I say old people, it could be people over 40 even, let alone people over 60 or 70 who think they're really wise, to be telling people who are 25 how to behave, because that would deprive the world of a lot of that youthful energy that needs to be expressed without without wisdom, I think, to a certain extent. So, yeah, I think you're right. And the other thing I would say that, you know, your comment inspired in me when you said it. One of the best. I've been fortunate, you know. And you pointed out some of my career highlights and achievements, and I've gotten a lot of accolades in my life, but there's very precious few that really mattered to me. Like, you know, when you get a compliment, you go like, wow, you remember the few that really matter. They really touch you. My son, Daniel, once said to me that the quality that perhaps that he most admires in me, that is rarest in his observation in people over a certain age, is that I have an unending desire to learn. and I'm constantly listening, and I'm constantly trying to challenge all my beliefs, and am willing and open to changing them and growing with new information. And I'm very proud of that. And he amplified that by saying, you know, in his experience, people over a certain age tend to shut down. They tend to say, well, I know what I know, and I know plenty. I've lived a full life. And then they become talkers instead of listeners, you know, and unwilling to allow their belief systems to be challenged anymore. And I think that's a form of death. You know, I think that's when you die, right? So I'll never do that. And I think that's a grave mistake made by older people. And I would, I don't remember if I touched upon that in my book or not, but it's certainly one of the most valuable compliments I've gotten in my life and observations about who I am. And I'm almost, you know, among the things that I'm most proud of, it's one of those things that I'm most proud of.
Well, you know, to me, it also sort of intertwines to some extent with what you wrote about in chapter 17 about don't share your unresearched opinions, please. And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, that is actually one of the things that my daughter will say, especially when it comes to politics, which I admire in her, is if you don't know, just say, you know what, I really can't form an opinion on that, or I don't have enough information. And I think that's very important. In fact, I think our country could be a lot better off if people stood by that.
Yeah. Well, there's no question. I mean, I learned that lesson very, very unequivocally from one of my earliest bosses. At that second savings and loan, I worked for a guy named Steve Trainer, who later worked for me. You know, life is funny that way, and Morgan Stanley, but we were very close. And Steve said to me when he hired me, he said, you'll never be fired for saying I don't know. But if you pretend to know something and you don't, you will be fired. And because then people, you know, then that whole act, you know, you create risky situations by pretending to know something you don't, and then acting and have other people acting accordingly. And there's never harm in saying, I don't know. You can't hurt anybody, right? People go, well, he doesn't know. Let me go ask somebody else, right? Or let's research it some more. And I really understood from that very young age. I think I was probably 22 years old when he told me that. And I never forgot it. It was really impactful to me. And that chapter, I think, is a very important chapter today more than ever, because in this social media world where everyone can amplify their opinions, I think temerity should be much more prominent than it is. People should be sharing opinions with great reluctance. How about that?
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, like you said, it doesn't always work like that. So your book is very insightful in many, many different components. I mean, I think there's, what's the total number of chapters? There are about 69 chapters, right?
Yeah, so, there's a prologue, so we'll get to 70 that way.
Okay. So
people are funny with the number 69, apparently.
Right. So when did this realization of all these different components, which is really, you know, it just really comes across, and it is, I believe, which is being very intuitive and really thinking and saying, you know what, these are either really important things that I've realized, or I didn't realize the impact that had, or that I should have looked at something a different way. When did that cross over, or was it a gradual thing that happened?
I think it's always been with me. I think that living life for me has always been both as the actor and the guy in the chair with a bucket of popcorn watching the movie. I've been the actor in the movie, and I've also been the observer at the same time. It's a funny way to live life. I've heard other people talk about that as well. So I know I'm not the only one who has that weird thing going on. But that observer, that person who's sitting watching the Ethan Penner movie go, and with a bucket of popcorn is taking notes. And so I think this book is the manifestation of sitting in the chair watching the Ethan Penner movie and taking notes along the way. And this is the result of the note taking over a 62-year life lived. So it's always been with me, you know. And I think that the first impetus to write a book like this was to pass down, for, like that, passing it down to their kids and ultimately giving it, hopefully passing it to grandkids and beyond. And it really grew out of a thought I had, just a thought. It just popped into my head, DJ, that if my, I don't know, great-great-great-grandfather had written a book like that with ideas formed from his experiences back in Europe, you know, in the 1500s, and I had that, and it was this kind of, I imagined it like this falling apart little book, you know, diary, that would be my most treasured thing. You know, I would refer to it all the time and I would love it. And I thought, well, why can't I create that? You know, and I won't be around 500 years from now, but maybe this book will be around. So these ideas can survive. And I think that's, you know, something that was very appealing to me. I know that you saw the chapter I wrote about music, and it was my observation about music too, that music lives forever. People die, but the music lives forever. Mm-hmm. Well, so do ideas, right? You know, we are reading, I don't know, George Orwell's ideas, and long after he's dead, with great kind of interest, almost renewed interest today because of the world. The world seems to have followed to a great extent, a weird extent, his vision at a time when it was incredible to have had that vision. And so we're reading, I don't know, Karl Marx's ideas, unfortunately, way past his personal expiration. And I think that that's what's cool about ideas and music. They get to live. And so I was hoping that I was going to write a book for my own family, as I had hoped someone had done for me in generations before me. And I actually wrote that book and called it, fittingly perhaps, What I Know, because in it was kind of all that I know. And that's really the genesis of this book. This book is what I know. Perhaps it's all that I know. I'm not really sure. It was written with great care and great respect for the reader, because as you know, the chapters are all 1 to 3 pages.
Yeah.
And the topics of each chapter are very, very interesting in the sense that I feel like I wrote 69 chapters. Each one of those chapters, if I had wanted to, could have been a book. I could have made a 200-page book out of any of those or all of those chapters. But out of respect for the reader and my, you know, my observation how time is our only valuable asset, it's because we can't make it any more of it, out of respect for people and time, I really worked hard to communicate my ideas with great brevity and great care.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned when you saw each other at the conference at the Institute a couple of weeks ago was how you had wanted to just print a copy or whatnot. You had to print, I think, what you wanted 10 copies. You had to print 100, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And you mentioned somebody got a hold of it overseas, mm-hmm. wasn't it?
Well, yes, that very first copy, first 100 copies, I kind of sent out into the world to friends and to people I would meet in business. And ultimately, one of those copies was found its way from a friend to a friend of a friend or a client of that friend who lives in the Middle East. And someone I had never met before. And I was introduced to that individual by my friend. He had my book and told me that he loved it. And after reading it, he kept the copy on his 12-year-old son's nightstand and would read a chapter with his son at bedtime and discuss it. And that really was one of the great inspirational moments for me. Moved me to say this book that I had written for my family is now finding deep value for other people, strangers really, and you know, to me, nothing or very, very little could be more inspiring than a father communicating values to his son through my words, you know, with my words getting an assist, you know. It's really cool.
Well, it's not, but it's not just that, Ethan. It's also that it was being done on the other side of the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's even something great. You know, I can, after going and reading your book, I mean, I can go through and talk about just how great it is. But I think that that really speaks for itself with that story that you just said. So, you know, your book, Greatness is a Choice. Where can people find the book? Is it out already? And so
the book is scheduled to be released by the publishing firm Wiley, which impressively is the oldest publishing house in North America. And they're releasing it at the end of October. It's available to be purchased today on pre-order for delivery at the end of October on Amazon and, you know, Borders and Barnes & Noble and all the other kind of online outlets. It's available in, it's only going to be sold in hardcover. It's a beautiful, I'm very proud of the design of the book. It's a very pretty, pretty book and a good keepsake. And anybody who reads it, I'm, you know, traveling all over all the time, happy to personalize it for anybody. I'm actually doing a lot of speaking around the book. And so we have a nice website. Our website for the book is greatintersection.com. But you could find it if you kind of just Google the book, it'll show up. But greatintersection.com. And in the website, it'll have where I'm traveling to and where I'm speaking, and people will be able to find me. I think the book is kind of like CMBS in 1991 that filled a massive, massive, massive void. I think, sorry about that dog. It's my favorite. My best friend is my Pomeranian, so I forgive him that bark. But, and if anyone met him, they would love him. But I feel like this book is analogous to CMBS in the sense that there's a big void in the world today. Very, very big void. And this book is aiming straight at that void. I think that the world that I grew up in was a world of values. It was a world of kind of a very religious country. We were shut down on Sundays through probably the time I was 25 years old. You literally couldn't go to, malls were shut, stores were shut, and even restaurants didn't open until the afternoon, giving people time to go to church. So the world has changed away from religious values and values, period. And I feel like my book, and I think we've lost a lot of common sense, you know, and I think that my book is a way for a reintroduction of that in a manner that I think young and old alike will find appealing. You know, it's not a contentious in your face book, which so much of what we see today is that it's partisan and it's you're wrong and I'm right and screw you. It's not any of that, really. It's about finding love and respect for each other and the pathway to that.
Well, if anybody has a chance to go hear you speak, they definitely should do that, because, you know, not only do you discuss aspects of your book, but you also go into your history and your life that you've lived, which, if you haven't already thought about, you should think about writing a biography, because I think that would be fascinating as well for, you know, that whole, especially during the time period that you created, what you created and the concerts and the people you've met and everything along the way. But Ethan, you know, great person, as many people have said. I mean, your wealth of knowledge is tremendous. Great person, great family man. And, you know, what you do provide in this book is a lot of things that you'll read. Anybody will read and they'll say, like, okay, I know that, but I just, it's been gone. It's been missing, you know, and it hasn't been on the forefront of my mind, and which I think is really important. And there's other components that really do make you think and say, you know what, maybe I should look at this a different way, or that's really interesting for what you had. So Ethan Penner, Greatness is a Choice. Make sure that you go out, you buy the book. You're definitely going to want to do that. And then if you have a chance to hear Ethan speak, you definitely want to do that as well. For sure, you'll get your money's worth and, you know, walk away with just, you know, feeling very happy that you sat there for whatever period of time and actually would want him to speak more. So, Ethan, thank you so much for being on the show. We look forward to having you on again. I mean, I know that we could go into many other things, so we'll have to do that at another juncture. But congratulations on your book, and we wish you well, and you know, hope to talk to you again soon.
All right, DJ, I really appreciate it. Always a pleasure to talk to you.